So the best thing that we can do is just meet that child where they're at in the moment. We don't want to enter and think, oh, they're not willing to do this. We want to think this isn't competent for them. I don't necessarily know why it's not competent right now, but the best thing I can do is take a step back and try again with a different goal.
Welcome back to the Upper Grand District School Board Social Learning Road Trip. Today, we welcome back Linda K. Murphy, author of The Co-Regulation Handbook, to chat with us about the framework surrounding her ideas, as well as around adjusting complexity. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, great to be back.
We are also welcoming our guest host for this episode's podcast, Carrie Conrad, Principal of Program Literacy, and her wealth of knowledge and experience with working with early learners. Welcome, Carrie.
Thanks so much, Tara. I'm really looking forward to being here in this conversation today.
We really wanted to invite Carrie's voice to our conversation today because she also carries with her, along with this literacy hat, experience working with early learners. And we think that this is a great place for us to integrate co-regulation into our practices. Did you want to share a little bit more, Carrie, about some of your experiences and how this book has already helped to sort of inform ways that we can integrate that into our practices?
Yeah, I would be happy to do that. Firstly, just thank you so much for putting together such a wonderful book that is written in a way that I think anybody can find a space within it and connect to what's in the book as well. As I was reading and thinking about the early years, I was really thinking about the play-based context that we have here in Ontario with our full-day kindergarten program. And so when we have students coming into kindergarten who are, you know, starting at as young as 3 years old, so a JK student would be anywhere from 3 to 4 years old, and they're entering kindergarten and sharing a space with 29, 28 other students, one of the things we know is that that's not a lived experience that they bring with them into their first days of kindergarten. And so when we think about that and in combination with the curriculum and program that we have for kindergarten, which is called a play-based kindergarten program, I think it's so important that we really think deeply and intentionally around co-regulation and how we're starting the year off, setting our students up for success. So often I've seen challenges where we interpret a play-based environment to be completely student-led, and that's different than being student-centered. And I think when I'm reading through this book and hearing what kinds of connections we can make to co-regulation and supporting our students, I really think about that difference between student-led and student-centered. And so starting off with those structured supports, those intentional actions and setup of our classroom, the environment, the materials, the language we're using, all outlined in this book, particularly throughout chapter 7, which I really connected well with, and thinking about how we could layer that into the start of the school year so that our students really have that support to learn how to self-regulate within that play-based environment, sharing and negotiating space and materials with, you know, up to 29 other students and 2 educators in the room as well. So I think there's a lot for us to take away here, and I'm looking forward to digging into that conversation around how we might apply some of this into that context and really look forward to a strong start in the upcoming school year.
And I really do think that that resonates so well with where we are in our learning. Last week, we explored how co-regulation can also build important social communication skills, conversation precursors, and executive functions. And one of the things I think that would be really helpful for us as we dive into the framework that Linda has provided in this book is to use an example of what is typical in our September classrooms. So I'd love, Linda, if you could just sort of review for us a little bit of this idea, the ideas that we learned last week about how co-regulation partners well with these conversation precursors as well as executive functioning. If we were to consider a JK student, junior kindergarten, coming into school for the first time, having not attended preschool, so they don't have any structured classroom experiences, maybe their home doesn't have a lot of structures in place either, and they're really new to this idea of sharing a space with 20 to 30 some odd little people. And maybe the first thing that you're noticing is they are having a really hard time finding a way to play, finding a way to just find a center or an activity or a job or anything that's working for them. Maybe they're just running around and they don't really have a way to sort of calm their body to just pause in one of the activities presented to them. What are some ideas as a review for us that we could try just to get going?
Yeah. And thanks, Carrie, too, for sharing all that information about how your classroom and model works. It's really nice to hear. I think what we can think about is if a student is coming into this environment and it's completely novel to them, then they don't yet have the world experience necessarily to know what to do or to how to navigate it or even how to make a decision around what they might want to play with first. So there's a lot of roles in that moment that are not yet competent for them, and therefore they are unsure what to do, feeling uncertain, running around, et cetera. So our first job in terms of establishing that co-regulation is just thinking about what's a competent role that we could offer this student or students as they enter the environment. So it could be something as simple as naming roles for them. Like, for example, you could be a book reader, you could be an art maker, you could be a dollhouse player. You could be a watcher. So even just naming observation as a valid and authentic role that students can have as they learn a new environment. Those types of things can perhaps ground students as they enter this new environment and figure out what they might want to do. And then you could think about how to create partnerships. They might need to be with a teacher first, because that teacher is going to be their master or their guide in this new environment to help them to know even how to use different materials in each section of the classroom. So if a teacher could be alongside them and creating partnerships within various roles to get started, that might be helpful to them. So maybe the teacher, for example, could be, you know what, I will be the book chooser and you could be the page flipper or something like that. Or I will be the art material chooser and you could be the art maker. So just thinking about how to create shared roles that help the students know what to do, that can ground them in the moment, while also just thinking about what roles are also competent for them given their developmental level right now.
And I love this idea of giving somebody a role with a name, the dollhouse builder or the Play-Doh maker. Like, that's great because it gives a very concrete way for a child to see their part in a classroom. It gives them a sense of that community, which I think is really important as well. So we've learned so far that we want to create these authentic, competent, contingent roles for our learners. But you have this great framework in chapter 6 we're introduced to, where you give us some very specific ideas around how we can create these roles, using sort of different levels of gradual release, I guess I would say. Can you share a little bit more about some of these ideas?
Yeah, so I think of these, or I call these co-regulatory frameworks, and they're just many different ways or a few different ways that we can create competent, authentic, contingent roles. They're all based primarily in motor actions rather than language. So that's just one way that demands can be reduced. A student can participate in a role but not necessarily have to talk, which can create competence in the moment. So the frameworks are, there's four of them. The first is assembly line, and that is just you, me, place. And that might be something like, I hand something to you and you put it in its place. So if you're at the book corner, it could be something like, hey, let's put the books on the shelf. I'll hand one to you and you could put it on the shelf. Or it could be passing out art materials. I'll give you a marker and you can put it on the table. Or I'll give you a marker and you could give it to your friend that's next to you. So it's just that assembly line. I hand something to you, you put it in its place, or vice versa. The next is complementary, and these are just actions that are different but related. So examples that come to mind to me are, I know I had talked previously about the idea of sweeping, and the little girl that I show a video clip of, she and her mom are sweeping, so she's the dustpan holder and the mom is the sweeper to start. So they're different roles, but they're complementary and both needed. Another one might be something like, hey, let's throw away the trash. I'll hold the trash barrel up and you can toss it in. So just ways that we're working together, our roles are slightly different, but they're connected. Parallel is one of my favorites. It's just we're doing the same thing at the same time alongside each other. So we had talked previously about the idea, I think, of taking recycling out. So that might be something where we're carrying a recycling bin together. I take one end, you take the other. Or sometimes if you need to move a table in a room or a piece of furniture, it could be moving it together with a student. Hey, I'll take this end of the table, you take that end. Or I'll hold this chair, you hold that chair. Let's carry these books at the same time to the bookshelf. Something like that, but just that motor movement. We're doing the same thing at the same time. And then reciprocal is just your more traditional turn-taking, where it's I take a turn and you take a turn. So we're setting up a dollhouse. It could be I'll put one piece of furniture in and then you can put the other in. Or if we're coloring together, I add a little bit of red and then you can add a little bit of blue, whatever it might be. But our turns look similar. We're just doing it in a reciprocal manner.
And would you say that this is something that you would gradually move through, as in you're starting with that assembly line, working towards reciprocal, or is there not necessarily a hierarchy that you're intending with that?
So there doesn't have to be a hierarchy, because at the end of the day, it's what's competent for the student that you're with. What will they most likely be able to do on their own? I have found, though, that assembly line is the easiest, probably. It's the lowest demand, the lowest pressure. So that, for me, is always a great place to start. And I think parallel can always be pretty easy, too, because we're just doing the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
Whereas complementary and reciprocal become more complex.
That makes sense.
Before I go into the next question, I just was thinking, too, when I was reading that chapter, one of the things that you talked about, and I think so important for educators to think about, and certainly us as parents as well, the importance of the students being successful, right, and feeling that success, and how we're picking those tasks that are the just right task for the students so that they will experience success. And again, I know that sometimes, you know, when we're supporting a full classroom with lots of students, we forget about the importance of breaking down those tasks into the right steps for each individual student and making sure that they feel that success, instead of kind of more broad, general, sweeping demands and instructions and those sorts of things at a whole class level, especially with our students who are having extra struggles with that self-regulation. So I just appreciated that when I was reading it, really thinking about making sure that the students from day one and each day are feeling successful in what it is that we're asking of them. So then that can, I guess, lead into the next question. In chapter 7, you talk a lot about that edge of competency. So let's say that we found the edge of competency and ensured that the student has been assigned to a role that's not too easy and it's not too hard, but we have a child who's still not willing to engage. What might we do in that situation where we think we've picked the right goal based on everything we've seen and in our time with our child or the student in the classroom, but they're still not willing to engage? What could some next steps for us be?
Yeah, and so this whole process is very dynamic, and we always, as you know, as the master, as the guide in the moment, we do our best, we make our best guess around what we think is that edge of competence or what's that just right role in the moment. But we have to be dynamic and be okay adjusting in the moment as needed. So if I invite a student to join and they don't, then I take a step back and think, okay, for whatever reason, this role is not competent right now. It might be that it was a little bit too hard. It might be that the child perceives it to be too hard. It might be that something is getting in the way at that moment in time that we just don't know what it is. It could be interoceptive awareness. It could be hunger. It could be fatigue. It could be maybe the child's thinking about something that happened earlier in the day. So the best thing that we can do is just meet that child where they're at in the moment. We don't want to enter and think, oh, they're not willing to do this. We want to think this isn't competent for them. I don't necessarily know why it's not competent right now, but the best thing I can do is take a step back and try again with a different role that maybe we thought would have been easier, but maybe is just right for right now. Because I think the most important thing is to find that place of engagement, which can vary. It might be a little bit different than it was yesterday. But if we can find what that place of engagement is right now, and we can support the child to engage, then we can always build up from there at a pace that feels comfortable to everybody. So for me, it's always kind of back up a little bit, try again. And I know this is a role that I had just mentioned, but sometimes maybe the just right role is for to let them be an observer for a little bit. Maybe they're feeling unsure whether they can do it or whether they feel comfortable joining. So in that moment, I might shift their role from, you know, drawer, for example, to watcher. Like, oh, it looks like you're not quite sure yet, or it looks like you're still thinking about whether you want to join. Would you like to be a watcher for a little bit, and then you can join when you're ready? And know that can be an active role also. And at the same time, you're modeling for them a really great learning strategy, which is to observe first, think about it, and then join.
Thanks. I love that. And I really appreciate that you spoke about taking that step back. I think about that as our own self-regulation and the need to really reflect on what we've chosen and why it might or might not be working without, you know, any blame or pressure, but just taking that step back and to just reflect before we think about what kind of that next request or next suggestion or next opportunity for that student might be. I think that's a really important step as well. For us as the either the parent or the teacher or the caregiver supporting the student in that moment. I know when I was reading chapter 7, another term that came up was you talk about scaffolding, and you talk about using that word over the term prompting. So can you tell us a little bit more about the difference between the terms and why we should think about them in a different way? And what would be some practical examples of scaffolding?
Sure. So for me, when I hear the word prompt, it is a couple of things. Like, it might be compliance-based, where we're just saying, do this. But then also it's not fostering thinking or initiation in the ways that can be really important. So with scaffolding, we're almost picturing like building a staircase, and we might need to think about what's the first step that I can provide or offer to this student so they feel comfortable just kind of getting on that staircase and working towards whatever it is we might be working on together. So we're creating that first step for them, or a step that they feel safe taking because they will be competent, versus just telling them to move ahead. Different scaffolding things that I think about might be, it could be modeling for them what I want them to do. So if they're going to color something in, instead of saying, you know, color this, a scaffold could be something like, hey, let me show you how I might do this. This is what I might do. And when you're ready, you could give it a try. Here's a marker for you. So I'm doing a little bit of modeling, but then I'm maybe doing a little bit of an assembly line where I'm holding the marker out for them to take it when they're ready, or even just placing it on the table. I might be close to them just to give them that emotional connection, right? That can help them feel safe, kind of branching out of their comfort zone and trying something new. And also, I'm going to go back to just the idea of competent roles and what role is just right for them at this moment. I don't need to prompt them to do the whole thing, but is there one small part of this process that they might feel comfortable doing? And that can be their role for right now, and they're experiencing prior to the process on their way to getting comfortable with the whole process. So those are just some examples.
Oh, those are wonderful examples. Thank you for sharing those. And I just am connecting that to back to that kindergarten, full day kindergarten environment that we talk about and that play-based learning model that we have. And one of the things that I've seen be so successful, which is really similar to what you're talking about, is when we have educators at the start of the school year, they have a really intentional and a bit more of a structured classroom where perhaps, you know, we know what's available for the students. We've limited the number of materials we've put out. We've limited the different spaces that they can go into. But what's so important and what I see really skilled educators do is that over the kind of course of the fall, as the classroom develops and the students build those self-regulation skills, they start to open that up and allow students more voice and choice. So for example, you know, we've been learning within these four or five centers in the classroom, but when we introduce another one, we add in some modeling. And this one, we have some conversation with the students. And I think you talk about this too, around adjusting complexities and offering those students, for example, a question around how many students, you know, could play in this center, and do you think would work for this center as we introduce it? And letting the students talk about what experiences they've already had in different centers. Well, you know, when we had six people playing over here, there weren't enough materials for us to share. And Kristen was really sad about that. So maybe we shouldn't have six. And so they can start to connect to those lived experiences and have more success in the classroom. When I see those sorts of things happening in kindergarten classroom, we really have a lot of success and students who are engaged and happy and having wonderful days.
Yeah, I love that. And that's really just weaving together so many of the concepts that we've been talking about and thinking about, from episodic memory to building on prior experiences to create competent roles as we learn new things.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful when you see everything brought together and the children really benefiting from it. So thank you again, Carrie, for offering that view for us. We really appreciate having you here today. And thank you, Linda, again for joining us and helping us dive deeper into the framework around co-regulation.
Yeah, thank you. Great conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
We look forward to chatting with you one more time, Linda. We'll be chatting about co-regulation in the classroom with an Upper Grand District School Board teacher and special education resource teacher, Amanda Pinnegar. She'll be joining us next week. So we look forward to that conversation as well. Thank you for listening to The Social Learning Road Trip, a podcast presented by Upper Grand District School Board. For educators within our board, you can access show notes and links to our other podcast episodes on our SharePoint page under Innovation Lab. Other listeners can find our podcast and additional information on our parent website at www.ugdsb.ca/CLS parents. If you would like to find out more information about declarative language and co-regulation, please visit Linda Murphy's site at declarativelanguage.com.